that we are not just brains on a stick that are walking on the earth, that when shame shows up, we happen to feel bad, and then we all get to the, you know, the big freeze that's going to happen in about 30 billion years, and the world goes dark, and that's the end of that. We who are Jesus followers would say that shame is not just a mechanical reality in the world. We would say that shame is something that evil is wielding to actively devour us and to prevent us from practicing the heaven that is coming. And that's why it's important. It's not important just because it makes us feel bad. It is important because evil, and just so you know this, evil doesn't care that you feel bad. Evil cares that you are devoured. Your very presence on the earth is anathema to evil. And remember, we are not, if you think that being a follower of Jesus is about believing the right things so that we, quote, go to heaven when we die, unquote, we haven't read our Bibles very effectively. Because I want us to recognize that the story of the Bible begins not in Genesis chapter 3. Many of us think we live as if it begins there. We live like the first thing we want to say is like we said earlier, like that we're sinners. And I want to suggest to you that's not where the Bible begins. The Bible begins with a vision for the world to be populated by kings and queens who will rule it with God as we were intended to from the beginning. And we mess things up. And when we did, God issued a rescue plan. And first he comes with Noah, and then he comes with Abraham, and Abraham can't do it. And then he comes with Moses, and Moses can't do it, and the Israelites, and they can't do it. David, not even David can do it. And finally we get to Jesus, and Jesus is going to do this. Are you with me? But then it gets to the point where Jesus doesn't just do it by himself, right? He's still, just like God with Abraham, just like God with Adam and Eve, Jesus wants collaborators. Jesus wants partners. Because he's trying to turn us into professional human beings. Heaven is not a place that we're going to go. Heaven is something that is coming. And when it gets there, if we are not prepared to live in it, will it crush us? If you've read The Great Divorce, the story of C.S. Lewis's story of people get on a bus in hell and they travel to heaven and see what happens to them, many of them can't even tolerate it. Why? Because the beauty is too much. Because the pears that have fallen off the tree, they can't even lift them off the ground. The grass hurts their feet because their feet are too fragile. God is trying to get us ready to live with him because he wants us to do the job that we were destined to do from the first page of the Bible. Are you with me? Evil wields shame to undo that whole project. Now, you can talk about shame a lot, like we're going to about the mechanics. And at the end of that, if you don't have an idea about what the story is in which it's embedded, we're going to be at a loss to have an ultimate sense of what we're going to do with it as we're going to talk about it. So here's the first thing we talk about when it comes to the mechanics of shame and the disintegration of creation, right? God's intention is for us to continually be creating newer and newer neural networks as we become outposts of Eden in the wilderness, expanding each one of us in our communities and together. The first thing we come to terms with is this notion that shame, first and foremost, is a neurophysiologic event. Before it becomes something attached to some meaningful thing in the world, I'm ashamed that I wasn't a good student. I'm ashamed that I wasn't a good enough son or a good enough daughter. I'm ashamed. All the things that I can name that I'm ashamed of, before we get there, we have to recognize that shame in and of itself, first and foremost, primarily is a neurophysiologic event. It is something that we feel in our chest, in our face, and we sense it long before we are coming up with words or stories that help me make sense of it. The neuropsychologist Alan Shore described this originally as Shane's action in the body is that of an accelerator and a brake and a clutch. Anybody here drive standard transmission cars? Right, so you know about this, right? So you have the accelerator, you have the brake, and you have the clutch. And what happens if you don't engage the clutch when your car is decelerating? What happens? It stalls. And does it stall calmly? No, it stalls violently, right? Right, okay. When you were born, and even beforehand, and you've heard of the sympathetic nervous system, right? And the sympathetic nervous system, not only is it part of your fight or flight system, but it's not the only thing that it does, by the way. It is sympathetic to your longing. It is sympathetic to what you want. And so the sympathetic drive system is the part of your brain that is in charge when you want to go do something, right? When you want to go. And babies are going from the moment that they come out. They're going. Even if they're just going by moving their arms and legs, they're going. And then they get to be toddlers, and they're really going. And then they, like, go off to work or college, and then they're just gone. And then they come back, right? But you see, like, that it is in go mode, right? It's the accelerator. You don't have to tell an 18-month-old to go. Just go. Our job is to try. What are we going to do? We have to find the brake. Right, because the 18-month-old is not going to find the brake on his or her own until or unless they're either like hungry or tired or whatever. But you follow me, right? We initiate the braking system by turning on what we call the parasympathetic system. And we will do this in any number of different ways as parents. Sometimes we will intervene with them when they're about to do something that is going to be dangerous. We move to intervene, move them out of that direction. Sometimes we have to do it quickly. We say, stop! And if we say stop in a hard way, we also quickly want to move to them, because we know that even if you are, you know, if you're approaching a red light, if you're approaching that light and you're driving a standard transmission car and the light turns red as you're approaching it, but you're several hundred yards off, you take your foot off the accelerator, you let the car coast, and then you gradually put the brake in, and then you just put the clutch in, and it's all very easy. But sometimes you know that, like, something happens and you have to slam on the brakes, and sometimes your clutch does not come immediately, but you have to follow it quickly thereafter, and you still don't lose the engine because you follow it quickly enough, but you have to slam on the brakes. Right, all of you standard transmission drivers, you know what I'm talking about, right? So when we say, as parents, that we're saying no to children, it's not that we say no, it's how we say it. There are times when we're going to say it quickly. There are times we're going to say it gradually. Shame is what happens when an engine decelerates and no clutch is engaged. It's what happens to the central nervous system. But the parasympathetic system downregulates the sympathetic system. And what is the clutch? The clutch for human beings in this downregulatory process is an interpersonal relationship. It's the connection that the parent makes with the child, that the board member makes with the CEO, that the pastor and the elder make when they're in when something's happening. Are you with me? It's what we do as couples. It's what we do, again, parents and children. I don't know. You know, my wife and I have just had the experience of ushering my mother-in-law into heaven back in December, who over a period of about 2 years. Fairly quickly descended because of vascular dementia. And so at times, I mean, if any of you have ever had to care for aging parents in this way, you discover some things about yourself as an adult. You didn't know that you could be as angry as you could be about your adult parent, right? You follow me. And you think, like, where did that come from? Within me, right? And so where is my capacity to be a clutch when what I want to do is just slam on the brake and let the engine fail? Are you with me? I mean, think about how many times have you ever been there? You people here have children, right? Gosh, you're so good. You're not quick to admit this. I mean, you have fun. I got no wonder. Like, is there something about the children in Kennedy Square? You know, admit this? Okay, this isn't being recorded, is it? Okay. Right. How many here have wanted, on at least one occasion, with every single one of your children, have you wanted to kill them? Right, right. And I think that every parent should have the right to do it at least once. Just once. And then, because we believe in the resurrection, we get it out of jail for you. And then we'll bring it up. And so you have to pick your time carefully. But you see what I mean? Like the moment, and there have been times when, you know, we have, as parents, we know that there have been times when we have slammed on their brake and we have not applied a punch. I know this. And this evokes something within us that is not then to be responded to or healed primarily by telling someone words. You don't have to be ashamed. We'll get to why that is in just a moment. But are you with me about the neurophysiology of this? This happens. And here's the thing. This process can begin as early as 15 to 18 months of age in a child. Right? Shame begins early. It happens often. We're well practiced at it as a human race. We're practiced at it as individuals because we get after it very, very quickly in our life. So that's the first thing we recognize. It's a neurophysiological thing, and the clutch of relationship is crucially important. And here's the thing. If I, as a parent, or as a friend, or as an elder board member with my pastor, if I have not taken care of my own internal business, it will be harder for me to play the role of being a proper clutch when I need to. As we like to say, the single most important variable in creating the space for a child to develop secure attachment with the parent, the single most important variable is the degree to which the parent has taken care of their own personal story. It's not about how many parenting classes I've taken. It's not about all the techniques. It's the degree to which I, Kurt, have become curious about and am able to take care of my own unfinished business. That's going to be the defining characteristic of how I then am able to help my kid develop secure attachment with me. So we see that it happens early and often. It moves to this pattern of disintegration to hiding and isolation. Notice, imagine shame. If we think about the orchestra metaphor, again, it's like we have these smaller to larger gradient of events in which someone comes in and is disrupting the orchestra in some way, shape, or form. Somebody throws a conductor off the stage. You've heard Dan Siegel talk about flipping your lid. The sense of my prefrontal cortex has just left the building and my brainstem is in charge. So, but my tendency is first I move to disintegration. And then I move eventually to actively hiding. Right? One of the things that's striking about the difference between what we call shame and what we call guilt is demonstrated in the research that looks at what people tend to do when they are having these experiences. The thing that we call shame, again, it's a word that we're using to describe a neurophysiologic and then eventually cognitive response to a circumstance, okay? This is something that develops early in a child's experience, 15 to 18 months of age. The thing that we call guilt, that word, that is a thing that we would say only emerges once a child, somewhere between or after the ages of 3 or 4 years of age. They're not able to develop this thing that we call guilt. Because what does that include, this thing that we call guilt? The thing we call guilt, we would say, it's where, you know, guilt is I've done something bad, and shame is I am bad. But how do I know that I've done something bad? Because my brain has to be developed enough for a couple of things to be true that are not true when I'm 15 months of age. One thing that is true is that I'm aware that there's a me and there's a you in the world. That I'm separate from you. A child's prefrontal cortex has to be developed enough to be able to recognize that. The second thing is that I have a sense of connection with you, and the thing that I've done that is wrong is not just a bad thing in and of itself, but I'm able to connect that thing to my relationship with you, this other person. Are you with me? And so my tendency, like, here's what the research I think is really fascinating. When you look at studies that have looked at what, and this is with like elementary school kids, with college age kids, when you look at what happens when somebody feels the thing that we call guilt in relationship to something that has happened between them and somebody with whom they have a connection, somebody with whom they have a, like an intimate relationship, It could be a parent, it could be a teacher, somebody that they respect, somebody that means something to them. When they experience guilt, their first impulse is to move toward them in order to reconcile them. I'm so sorry. Will you forgive me? Can we work this out? I'm moving toward you. Guilt tends this thing we call guilt. Because I have a sense of like there's a me, there's a you, I can move toward you and we can do something together. With shame, I don't do that. I do not move toward another person. I turn away from somebody else. This is the other physiologic phenomenon. I typically tend, my shoulders will turn in. If you've watched the dog, what does the dog do? Put their head down and so, like when I, we will turn our faces away, children will turn away, they will run away. And one of the reasons why it's so striking, when you look at the scriptures, how much more frequently when the scriptures talk about the notion of sin, how much more frequently the whole notion of shame is entangled with it. Even more so than the notion of guilt. Because the writers of the Bible know what it means to be human. And you see, our sin, like our shame, is something for which I'm not going to come to you to sort this out. You're going to have to come find me. Are you with me? So this is what I will actually do. I will start to hide it from you. I will start to hide from me. I won't want my shame to be something I'm paying attention to. Remember, we said at the beginning, we're all in these boats that we've constructed, sitting on this ocean of fear of what's underneath that, this sub-ocean of shame. It's touching the third rail. I can't imagine being in that space. Which is why I'm going to need somebody to come and find me, to invite me into that space in order for us to do the untangling that we'll talk about. This notion, the movement toward stasis, this is the other thing. Like, if we were made to create this, movement is one of the primary biological signs of life. We don't think about rocks as being alive. But everything that we say is living, even bacteria, one of the ways that we know that they're living, they're moving. Movement. And as human beings, we were made to move. We are made to move rhythmically. But we are also made to move creatively. We are intended to make things. What is the next? If you could not be ashamed, inappropriately, if you could not be ashamed inappropriately, what would be the next thing you would make? What would be the next adventure you would take? What would be the next risk you would take? What would be the next hard conversation you would have? What would it be if you couldn't be ashamed? What evil does in wielding shame is that it gets us to a point where we are not creating. We are not taking risks. We are not making things. This is what evil is doing. It doesn't care if we just feel bad. We can feel bad, but it wants to make sure if you feel bad, then maybe you just won't make stuff. Are you with me? And this is crucially important. Because I'm just left feeling bad without being aware that that's not my biggest problem. My biggest problem is that I am now not moving into creating those works that have been prepared for me from before the foundation of the world. And so it moves us towards stasis, towards immobility. We all know, there are things that we have relationships where that feel immobile. We have marriages, perhaps even in this room, that feel immobile. And I will say that when we find ourselves in that space where we feel immobile, I will tell you that shame has taken up residence. When we say that we feel stuck, I will tell you, shame has taken up residence. And the real question is, what would it be like for us to then begin to identify its presence and how it is running roughshod over those 9 domains that we've talked about? How it is interfering with those things that God has called us to make in the world. And part of shame is, it gets me to a point where I'm not even willing to take the risk of imagining what the things are that I want to create. Because there's too much risk of more shame happening. It's self-perpetuating. This is self-explanatory. We feel ashamed, and then we feel ashamed, and we feel ashamed. And then it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And this is why we don't want to look at it, because the more I look at it, the more I feel it. which is why we need someone else to come and fight us. Cognitively, this is crucial, cognitively, the primary feature of shame is that of condemnation. There is therefore no condemnation for those of us who are in Christ Jesus. Great. This is Paul's magnum opus within his magnum opus, Romans chapter 8. I don't know if there's been a more hopeful, powerful piece of literature written. No condemnation. Here's the thing. Moment to moment, day by day, month in and month out, we collect moments of condemnation. And most of the condemnation we collect, we are directing at ourselves. And in fact, it's so subtle and so ubiquitous, we don't even know that we're doing it. Most of the time, we don't use words. It's a felt sense of things. It's a choice not to have the phone call. It's a choice not to go to the party. It's a choice not to do this, not to do that, because we had just this, that I don't want to contend with this thing that I feel right here. Now, I can have a story. I know that I have a story that's about this. But I don't even want to start to talk about the story. Because the moment I start to talk about the story, my attention is drawn to this thing that I sense that I don't want to have anything to do with. Are you with me? Death of a thousand cuts. Most of our shame experiences are not blatant, singular, monadic moments where someone says, you're a horrible person. They are these small moments, granular moments, throughout the course of our day that are in the privacy of our minds in which I'm thinking, I should have done this. I should have done that. Ugh, that wasn't good enough. You with me? I think you are. Right? And we're doing it. Like, and my guess is it's been happening here in the room since we started. Like, I should have put that on the list. Now, we could say, well, Kurt, you know, look, you're being a little extreme. You're like, no, I really should have put that on the list. I get it. But the thing is, we practice saying it with the tenor of shame. Remember, it is not just the language. It is the neurophysiology. It is the felt sense of what it is that we are doing to ourselves. And then condemnation that we offer to ourselves is really, ultimately, this harbinger. Because it comes to the death of a thousand cuts, we don't even know that it's happening. And it's a harbinger of this haunting line in Genesis. That it's not good for the man to be alone. It's a haunting line that portends abandonment. That should be Genesis 2:18, not Genesis 3:18. Genesis 2:18. Shame's primary mission is to have us become so disconnected from ourselves and from others that we are unable even to access imagining that we need others, let alone that we will call for them for the help that we need. Are you with me? Once again, C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. The opening chapter describes hell as a place where people build their homes farther and farther and farther apart from each other. This haunting line, it's not good for the man to be alone. Then it starts to show up. Notice what happens in the next page. The snake comes, and the snake does not say to Adam and to Eve, hey, I know God comes along at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon every day. When he comes today, I just want the four of us to have a conversation. No. And even when he begins to have the conversation, he's directing his words to a particular one of them. He doesn't talk to both of them. He's just talking. He said to the woman. Now, we don't know all the details. Like, was she out fishing and he just happened to find her out by the pond? Was like, were they already separate? But the notion is like, he doesn't do anything to bring them together. The text would indicate that Adam was present because he was with her. She gave him some fruit because he was with her. We figure he may be in on this conversation, but whatever is happening, the snake is moving deftly to have an isolated conversation. Are you with me? Just like each of us have isolated conversations in the privacy of our own mind. Just as us imagine that other people are having those private conversations in the privacy of their mind about us. And this is all about taking us further and further and further and further away from relationship. Symptoms, primarily, I tell people, look, The first primary neuroaffective response that human beings have to distress is that of a thing that we call anxiety. We've all sensed that we sense it emerges in different ways for different people, but ultimately, anxiety is a physiologic harbinger that I'm about to be left. When people walk into my office and they've got their depression and their anxiety and so forth and so on, they say, I think my brain is broken. There's something wrong with me because I haven't been able to get out of bed in 2 weeks. We say, look, it's important for you to know that, yes, there are things that are going on that we want to be different, but it's also equally important to know that your brain is doing exactly what it should be doing under the circumstances that you're asking it to live. Are you with me? What your brain is doing is trying to send you a signal that it has been alone for far too long. It's reaping the end of Genesis chapter 3. That's what your brain is doing. This is not to suggest that it's all that you're depressed because of your sin. It is not about that. This is about the mechanics of what happens when we become isolated from one another and from ourselves, and how evil is going to wield shame as a way to accelerate that process. Does that make sense? And so I tell when I'm doing training for clinicians, you want to say, look, patients are coming for your skill sets. Patients are coming for your psychotherapy skills. They're coming for your EMDR. They're coming for your neurofeedback. They're coming for your brain spot. They're coming for, perhaps, if you're a psychiatrist, they're coming for your pharmacology. They're coming for your CBT. They're coming for everything. But I want to tell you, even if they're not aware of it, the most important thing that they're coming for is you. The challenge is, we as therapists don't necessarily believe that that's the case. We are not aware of the power that God has infused within us from the beginning, such that our gaze landing on someone else has the capacity to bring healing. But we can't give what we don't have, and consequently, it will be hard-pressed for me to believe this if I am also not having that same experience myself. And so for those of us who are therapists in the room, the real question is, who is taking care of you? Because if there isn't someone whose job it is to take care of you without you asking them any questions, at some point you will run out of gas. And the problem will not be that you're not trained enough or that you don't have enough information. The problem will be that you're alone. One of the reasons why, I work in this practice in Northern Virginia, where we have now about 8 clinicians, and I'm just aware that if I don't have them every Wednesday from 11:45 to 1, like I'm a dead man. I've got 3 other guys that I meet with and have been meeting with every Tuesday morning for 25 years. And if I don't have them, I'm a dead man. If we are not in a position in which someone is coming for us, this is what we will become. And the thing is, we can be skilled enough, educated enough, trained enough, we can be Christian enough, such that we might get along pretty well for a long time, but we won't be aware of the parts of us where shame is still embedded, in which you're burning a ton of energy to keep it out of the room. And that energy is then not going to be available for you or for God to do the creative work that he wants to do with you, that he has set aside from before the foundation of the world. And so we are in need of the same things that our patients are in need of. Everybody is. And everybody has a bullseye on their chest because evil is not about to go quietly into the night. This ends what happens. We talked earlier about how we are storytellers. And what we learned, storytelling part two, what we learned is that evil wants to tell a different story. You know, I had a patient this person's now in their mid to late 60s, but when I started to see them when they were in their late 30s, early 40s. And this person, when they were 19 and they were in college, this person, I got a phone call from her dad. And her dad said, I just want to let you know, I'm leaving your, she's living in Northern Virginia. I'm leaving your mother and I'm moving to Seattle where I have another family. Now this is way back in the day. This is no internet, no, like you wouldn't be able to know. This is, he traveled on business and so forth. He didn't just like have an affair. He had a family and this woman had not, this other person had not just one, but two children. You're like, wow, humans, man. Like we got it going on. You know what I mean? And then he says to her, to my patient, he said, but you just need to know it's not your fault. It's got nothing to do with you. Now, we can think what we want to think about all this, but the point is that it would be impossible for her to believe it's not her fault. How in the world can a person make a decision and think that, like, if, like, this is, like, what else could I have done? Like, he can certainly, there's something about this other family that he can choose that is enough. Somehow, I wasn't enough to be chosen. This is how the story goes. Are you with me? This guy wants to do whatever he wants to do, and of course, he's, like, he doesn't want to feel too bad about it. So he's going to make sure that his daughter knows that it's not her fault, and in some respects, you know, you can understand his argument and so forth and so on. It doesn't matter. That's not the story that she actually is able to believe. Are you with me? When you open the page, when you open the Bible to its third page, you hear a story that starts to open up. And the story that the snake is telling is this. Hey, I just want to let you know, that tree over there, tell me, like, did God say you can't, like, do that fruit? He's asking a question. And then she tells him the answer. Yeah, we're not allowed to eat. We're not even allowed to take it, which, of course, we already know, right? Somewhere in the translation between Adam and Eve, somewhere there's been a miscommunication about something. Because now she's, like, she's, you know, adding to the story. Something's going on. And he says, well, you know, he knows something if you eat this. Now, notice, who's he talking about? He knows. But who's he talking about? He's talking about God. He knows that the day that you eat thereof, he knows, like, you're not just going to not die. You're not, you won't, surely you won't die. Not only that, you will become like God. He knows this. Now notice what evil is doing. He's talking about God, but he's talking to her. And he's ultimately talking to her about herself. Because the end of the message is, it's not just that God won't let you do this, it's you're not okay enough for him to let you be like him. Are you with me? This is what happens within her. A story is being generated so subtly because he's talking about her. He's letting her draw conclusions about herself. Are you with me? This happens to us all the time. This is what was happening to my patient. She's hearing her dad say it's not your fault and she's drawing a different conclusion. So then when Eve picks the fruit, we can recognize that already shame has been at work, long before any fruit gets eaten. There's the shame. I'm like, you're not enough to be like him. Are you with me? It's subtle. The Hebrew writers are brilliant. It's very subtle. And this happens to us all the time. We sense something. We feel something, right? And he doesn't say, hey, by the way, if you want it, before you eat the fruit, like, check this out. When God comes around, let's have a conversation. No. No. That's not what evil does. It helps us tell a different story. That God is a tyrant. That I'm inadequate. I'm not worthy. All the things about me. Does that make sense? But we walk around repeating this in all kinds of ways. And then you get it. You move from what happens in Genesis 3 to then you get to John 9 and you see it writ large. So if you're familiar, because we see like this is happening with one person, with the woman. By extension, it infects the man. Then they're affecting each other. And then you have Cain and Abel. By the way, we like to say, you know the story of Cain and Abel, right? Yeah. Did they teach you this here? Like Cain killed Abel because Abel wasn't able to kill Cain? Did you hear? Did you? Yeah. Notice, Notice what God said to Cain. Notice God said, wait, sin is crouching at your door, and its desire is for you, and you must master it. And if you do, will you also not be exalted? It's a question we often miss in that conversation. Will you also not, you the firstborn, who's not been chosen but is being tested right now? You mean your parents were tested and they had trouble with the test. Now I'm going to test you. This is a test. This is an opportunity for you to become more like me. Are you with me? Will you also not be exalted? And like, if I'm Cain, I'm having a hard time imagining this. And we'll get to this about trauma and shame, about how it truncates our imagination. He can't imagine that he will be exalted. And so killing his brother, just like taking the fruit, is a way for Cain, just like Eve, to cope with your shame. And then it just multiplies. And before you know it, you go from Cain, then you go to the rest of his friends of the Bible Project would say, you know, everything you need to know about human beings you can read in the first 9 chapters of Genesis. You use the first 9 chapters of Genesis, you get everything you need to know about us. Which is true. But if we go a little farther than that, you get to the 9th chapter of John, we find this happening. If you're familiar with the story of John 9, and it's a blind guy, and they come upon the man born blind. Remember this story? Notice, he doesn't even get a name. Right? You know, like Bartimaeus, at least got a name. Like, this cat doesn't have a name. He's a man blind from birth. And what's the first thing that happens? Okay. It's a lively audience. Okay, what's the first thing that happens? Right, the disciples said to Jesus, who sinned? Him or his parents, such that he was born blind. Notice what's happening. Like, condemnation is at the ready. This is the culture in which they live. This guy was already an object of condemnation. He represented, he was an embodied form of the condemnation of the culture. He was kind of like the sinkhole for it. Are you with me? Now what does Jesus say? Neither he nor his parents sinned, but this man was born blind. Why? Such that the glory of God, such that the works of God might be revealed. Notice what's happening. Jesus comes to where shame is not just in one person, but where the shame of an entire culture has become embodied and represented by one person. And Jesus turns it on its head. He comes and he looks for it. Now, you know, you think that the disciples, they had other options. They'd be like, oh my gosh, Jesus, he's a blind guy. If you heal this guy, we'll get it on Instagram. It's going to be awesome, right? This is just going to be fabulous. But this doesn't happen. They are encultured. Their plausibility structure, their anthropology, everything about them has them immersed such that the way that they understand the world is that the world is a problem to be solved. And Jesus shows up and says, no, the world is an object of beauty that is waiting to be revealed, and I'm here to do it. And then, when I've done this, then I'm going to condition you all to be doing the same thing. Which means it's going to be hard for you to see the world as an object of beauty being revealed if all you're able to do is to see your own selves as a problem to solve. Because when we get to the totality of John 9, as Leslie Newbegin points out so rightly, he says John 9 is not a story about people who can see and people who are blind. It's a story about people who are blind and know it, and people who are blind and don't. We're all blind because shame has taken on this large of a role. We go from Genesis 3 to John 9, and you find that it's an entire system that shame is in charge of. It's not just a collection of individuals who happen to have the problem of being blind. It's an entire system that is controlled by it. Are you with me? So, what do we do? So we're going to take the last part of our time. I think there's been a couple of different schedules floating around. I think we may go until 12. Is that right? We go to noon? Yeah. Okay. All right. I hope so, because that's what we're doing. All right. Okay. Here's the first thing. This is part 3 of the storytelling. And when it comes to this notion of shame, I want to invite us to consider that, consider what parts of our own stories, as we're sitting here today, what parts of our stories would we be able, upon reflection, to say, oh, there was a time when I told my story this way, But now I don't tell that story the same way. I tell a very different one. Parts of my story, right? Many of you work with the process of internal family systems, and we talk about this notion of there being an whole family of parts of us that occupy our inner lives. And there are, like I have, for instance, I have this part, not surprisingly, given the story that I told you about how I came into the world, I have this part of me that believes he's unwantable. Not just that he's unwanted by others, that would put the onus of responsibility on somebody else, but that it doesn't matter who you are. Like, at some point, you're going to find the part of me that is unwantable, and then you're going to go. And I believe this. I mean, now that part of me believes this. And I'm having to have conversations with that part of me because he's still in the room and he still believes these things. Less so than maybe 5 years ago, but still, you with me. And we each, in this room, have parts of us that are like unto that. It may not use that particular word, but we have each of us, these parts that are blind. These parts that are blind, and we know them. But some of us, like some of those parts, they're so painful that we're going to do whatever we can to make sure that nobody sees them. And that energy that I burn at some point is going to morph into the symptoms that I have because my brain is saying, I'm done doing that. I'm done hiding all of these parts of you that are staying inside the boat and are afraid to get out to get into the water where you can be healed and you can be transformed, sometimes even convicted about the addiction behavior that you have that has to be refrained from in order for us to get you onto the path of creating beauty and goodness in the world. And so this whole notion of telling stories differently is the work that we do as human beings. This is not just for therapists. This is not just for pastors. This is what it means to proclaim the good news. Imagine this. Imagine that in the course of just having a conversation with anyone, one of your friends, the very act, I was talking earlier with Bob and Carrie up here about this whole notion of storytelling. And how, when we talked earlier about how the listener is as much a part of telling the story as is the one who's telling the story. Because how many of us have had experiences with someone who's really listened well to us tell a part of our story, and the more that we tell them, the more of my story comes forward that I didn't even know that I was carrying. You ever had that experience? So like my friend that I talked about in the last hour, who, like, you know, grew up in a loving Christian home, that's his story, until you start to have somebody listen to him telling his story differently. And he discovers there's parts of his story that he's been working really hard for over 40 years to pretend doesn't exist. Are you with me? And so the storytelling, imagine, you come into the room and you ask, so how are you really? And you don't even have to be a therapist. You can be having coffee with your friend at Starbucks. You can do this. And you're asking the questions. Just like Jesus asked questions of a woman in John 4. He asks her questions. Can you give me a drink? Can I have a drink? He's asking her questions. Oh, bring your husband. He's having a conversation. He's not proclaiming the gospel as we might like put it in our categories right out of the chute. He's asking her questions. He is helping her tell her story. She has been telling the story for a long time, and that is one of like, I don't deserve anything. Are you with me? And he, in listening to her, is already helping her tell her story differently without him having to tell all of it. Are you with me? Okay, here's another one. You get to Mark chapter 5. All these people in the Bible that don't have names, right? Okay, Mark chapter 5, right? Jesus comes back from healing the demoniac. He steps onto the shore, and immediately, like the local pastor says, my daughter is sick, will you come? He hops out of the boat. They're going hard, and there's a big crowd. We know the story. And then we see there's a pause. Now there was a woman who had a bleeding problem, right? For 12 years, Mark 5:26, my least favorite verse in the Bible. For 12 years, she had suffered at the hand of many doctors and had spent all she owed, right? She had no more money because doctors were not helping her. But she had heard about Jesus. Notice, she hadn't even heard him. She'd heard about him. And somewhere within her, she hatches a plan, right? Just like your patients hatch a plan. They come into your office and they have a plan for what they're there for, right? We're there to take care of this problem. And they don't know this as much as she did, but she was in, like, she was invested in what we would call commando healing. Right? She's going to come in, get the job done, get out. Nobody knows. Nobody gets hurt. Are you with me? Right? Because if all I do is touch the hem of his garment, I know I will be healed. And then she does, right? She's, there's all these problems. And Jesus, and she's like, and he stops. Who touched me? And she's like, crap. Right? It's like something going really bad for the, like, SEAL Team 6. It's like, it just, it's not working. Now, what's interesting about the text, Mark's text tells us, for she knew in her body that she had been healed. She knew in her body, right? She's mud and she's breath. She knew in her body that she'd been healed. But notice what the text tells us is what she later said. The text doesn't tell us everything. I mean, these writers, oh my gosh, they're just like maybe winning Oscars every year, right? The text tells us what she thought. And what she thought was that she had been healed because her body told her so. Until he says, stop. Who touched me? And now the story going changes. Who touched me? And the disciples are like, you know, they're like, what do you mean with all these people pressing around? Like, they don't get it. And he said, I felt healing. And he continued to look into the crowd. Are you with me? He's coming for her. We're not told that he knows who it is. Like, he's like, he's a real guy. He doesn't know everything. And he comes for her. And then what does it say? With fear and trembling. I will tell you, the fact that she comes with fear and trembling tells us already that her healing is not yet done. And he knows this. Because the next thing, and she came to him, and Mark's text says, and she told him everything about her. Which means all the things we just read, she tells him. And then he says, my daughter. When's the last time she's heard this? You're mine. Mine. Daughter. Mine. You belong. It's the first thing we need to know. Healing doesn't mean much if you don't belong. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. Notice, you still have more healing to do. And when you pan out, you see, oh my gosh, this is a woman who, though her bleeding has stopped, does not have a family, does not have a husband, does not have children, she doesn't have a job. Like, what the heck is she going to do? Are you with me? Her shame was not just about her bleeding. Her shame was about everything else that her bleeding was responsible for. And just because her bleeding stopped did not mean it magically gave her a new life. And those of you who see patients know that you can have moments of insight. You can have moments of all kinds of transformation that happen in your office, and you know that the healing has only just begun. Because evil is only going to continue to reprocess shame, because it's going to depend upon the old neural networks that we have in our brain that we'll continue to use over and over and over and over again, which is why healing is the beginning of a new story that we tell. And that was true for her. That would have been true for the man in John 9. Like, figure, like, look, if you looked at all the people that Jesus heals in the Gospels, in just about every case, they get healed and all hell breaks loose. Like, think, like the guy in John 9, he gets his sight, and then he loses his community. Right? Matthew is drawn to Jesus, and now he's out in public. Where are the disciples? Like, you watch The Chosen, you see what they do to him. You know what I mean? And so we have to recognize that the healing of shame is about our being part of this story that we are telling and that we are helping to tell. Jesus was helping to tell her story, not just by telling it to her. In John 4, not just by telling it to her, but by inviting her to be part of this storytelling process. She had to come forward. She had to go and now tell her story differently. Are you with me? And so we see that the gospel is being proclaimed not just because we have a set of propositions that we give to people. It's proclaimed in your very act of being curious with people. You are the gospel. If you don't believe that, then we can't take seriously that we are the temple of the Holy Spirit. What we read about in 1 Corinthians 6:19, and the Spirit is coming from us, coming for others, as we are helping them retell their stories, because our stories have been retold by the Jesus who is the one who's coming for us. Are you with me? But I can't do this by myself. So we're just going to look at one set of verses here, and we're going to talk about what we mean by this. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 2. We're going to just walk through this real quickly. As a way for us to imagine a template for what are we doing not just to heal shame, but what are we doing to create outposts of beauty and goodness in the world? Because we are not primarily shame problems. Shame happens to be a symptom that we target in order for us to invite people to tell their stories more truly and in a way that heretofore they couldn't even begin to imagine. Therefore, since we have before us such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off all the sin that so easily entangles us and run with perseverance the race that has been set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him disregarding its shame, and now sits at the right hand of God. Therefore, since we have before us such a great crowd of witnesses. Now, this is chapter 12 of Hebrews. It follows chapter 11. It has this list of all these people, many of whom are alive, many of whom are not alive. Here's the question for us. Who are our crowd of witnesses? It is important to know that we do not do any of this apart from community. And we can try to do this apart from community, but we don't do it very well because the brain is not meant to live in isolation. Are you with me? If we're going to begin to be curious about what we're going to do to respond to this shame, the first question is, who are the cloud of witnesses? Who would be the 3 to 4 people who, if you were to give me their names and I were to poll them, I could ask if they could tell me everything there is to know about you collectively? By whom are we being so deeply and regularly known that they are witnessing the story that I'm telling and they are in fact helping me to tell the story that I'm trying to tell, and I'm doing the same thing for them. Since we have such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off the sin that so easily entangles us. So here's another thing that's important for us to know. And we're going to talk about this notion of confessional communities. We're going to touch on it here, then we're going to get to it more in the afternoon. One of the things that I like to talk about is that's just kind of emerging, especially in this work with this group work that we do, is what I would consider to be the physics of relational mass effect. The physics of relational mass effect. If you were to find yourself on a sidewalk and suddenly discover that you're being approached by a small red wagon, you know, a little red wagon, some kids in school, right? A small red wagon at 3 miles an hour, that's walking pace. If you were to discover that, it would be weird, right? Because you look up and there's a wagon coming 3 miles an hour. But if you were to want to stop it, all you would need to do would be put out your foot and it would stop. If you're standing on a railroad track and you see a locomotive that is approaching you at 3 miles an hour, you couldn't do a thing to stop it. But it's not because of its velocity. It's because of its mass. Its mass effect. Shame is a locomotive. It's not a red wagon. And the way that we push against it cannot be on our own. What we do as people who are people of healing is that we're going to build a bigger drain. I do not have what it takes to push against the neural payload of shame that exists in my brain. I don't have what it takes, which is why I need those three other men on Tuesday mornings. why I need the couples that have been part of our covenant group for 30 years, why I need the handful of people who are in my life who keep me from losing my mind. Because they're a locomotive. Because the one that I have to contend with that's in my own life, my own unfinished business, is way too big for me. Even Jesus, in Luke's gospel, at the crucifixion, notice Jesus does not say, I forgive you all for you don't know what you're doing. He asks for help. Father, forgive them. And not only that, imagine the other help he had. It's also in Luke's gospel where we read, you know, every single gospel tells the story in Gethsemane. That Peter cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant. Right? Remember this story? Right? He comes, he cuts, he gets out his sword, he whacks off his ear. Jesus heals it. That's in John's gospel. Jesus heals it. Then he says to Peter, whose gospel, put away your sword. Do you not know that should I want it, I could call on my Father and he would send 12 legions, 60,000 troops. I gotta tell you, folks, like, that's not metaphor. This is an appeal to Elisha. You know the story of Elisha. Elisha, when Jerusalem is surrounded and his assistant is scared to death, and Elisha prays and says, God revealed to him what he needs to see. And the assistant looked. And the armies of heaven were surrounding the city. I don't have any doubt that there were 60,000 troops that Jesus could see. On Good Friday, waiting for the captain's call. And it just never came. But I can tell you that it would be a lot easier for someone to choose not to make the call when you know you can. Because you're not by yourself. We make a mistake when we read Matthew's gospel. Father, my God, why have you forsaken me? And we don't complete the entire 22nd Psalm. This is a God who has made us like him, and we cannot do our life without living, knowing that there are 12 legions of angels who are at the ready. By whom are we being known? Who is our collective body of people who are bearing witness to our lives? Therefore, since we have such a viewing host, let us throw off the sin. I'm able to throw sin off only because somebody else is going to help me do it. But this does come to a point where each of us has our own addiction. We've got multiple addictions. We all do. Right? And the question is, am I really willing to do the work that I have to do to restrain that? Nobody can do that for me. I'm going to have to do that, but it's much easier for me to do it in the presence of others who are also working really hard to do the same thing. We like to say the brain can do a lot of really hard work for a really long time as long as it doesn't have to do it by itself. And so I'm going to have to restrain. I'm going to have to say no to all kinds of behaviors that are my way, just like Eve's taking of the fruit, that are my way of coping with the parts of me that I don't want to have to pay attention to. And if I'm willing to do that, then we run the race that is set for us. Once again, I wish that I could be master of my own destiny. I could set all pace for my race and so forth. But today, you know, many of us, maybe, again, as we said, maybe you've got the news already today that you can expect. Between now and this time next week, some of us are going to get news that not only we don't expect, we don't like. It's the race that's been set before you. And we're being given that opportunity to decide, am I going to now allow my cloud of witnesses to come for me, or am I going to choose to do this by myself? This is what we're inviting our patients to do. Because our patients, you know, it's like we live in a world in which we've been so, by modernity and post-enlightenment, we've been so atomized. We all believe that we live in these silos of individuality that we don't really live in, but this is how we believe we live, that I have to do this by myself. We even get married couples. We marry couples and then we say good luck. And if you get into trouble, we'll send you to a marriage therapist. without recognizing that they need so much more support in a world that is trying to tell them otherwise. Are you with me? And so in this space, I'm going to run the race that is set for me that I can't decide, fixing my eyes on Jesus. And then what does it mean to fix our eyes on Jesus? This means many, many things. We don't have time to talk about all this. But to fix our eyes on Jesus primarily is a way for us to see who he is and do what he does. One of the things that he does is that he spent time in the desert in the wake of hearing his father say, "You're my son whom I love. You're my daughter whom I love." How many of us wake up in the morning? How often do we practice waking up in the morning? And, you know, like it was this morning. Did you see them? In your bedroom? Now you're really worried, aren't you? The Holy Trinity? In your bedroom. You wake up, and you're like, "Oh my gosh, we're so glad you're awake. We've been waiting for you all night. I know that you're going to go to this conference. You're going to hear the shrink. It's going to be awesome. We're all going to be, you're going to have such a great time. It's all going to be great. And then you're going to come home. You're going to have a great dinner tonight. And we can't believe that we get to do this with you." This is what the Trinity is trying to get our attention, to hear us, hear him say, like, all the time. The question is whether or not I'm paying attention to it. The question is whether or not I'm embedded in a series of relationships that enable me to pay attention to it when shame is calling, trying to tell me a different story. Are you with me? And so in this sense, when we are fixing our eyes on Jesus, we're fixing our eyes on someone who's paying a lot of attention to a father who's saying, like, "Dude, I am so glad to get to be your dad." And he's saying the same thing to us. He says the same thing to us all the time. It's just that Jesus was really good at paying attention. And what does it mean then for us to watch what he does, do what he does, the author and finisher of our faith, someone who comes at the beginning, who sees us and comes at the end? Here's something that's important to know. We like to say in our work, things are not ultimately real for human beings until they feel them, until we feel them in our chest. You can say all day long that God loves me, and until I sense it here, it's just theology. Now, it's not nothing. If it is theology, it's not nothing. But it's not yet reached its fullness unless I sense it here. For the woman in Mark 5, her bleeding healing was not nothing, but it wasn't the fullness. The man in John 9, his sight being returned, it's not nothing, but it's not the fullness. If I don't sense it here, because the brain operates bottom to top and right to left, first I have to sense before I make sense of what I sense. If I'm merely thinking that I can be transformed or formed from a left to right, top down form, I'm missing the point about human beings actually operating the world. And so once I'm paying attention to this, I'm sensing that the author and finisher is someone who's not just trying to finish this faith, this thing I believe. He's trying to complete a sense in which I fully in my embodied, fully embodied self, wake up in the morning and I imagine, oh my gosh, I sense the Spirit in the room. You're like, "Dude, I thought that was just for the Pentecostals." Probably not a Pentecostal church here, are we? No, but you know what I mean? Like, I thought that was something that was, no, this is basic interpersonal, this is basic neurobiology. That in order for me to live fully in the world, I have to then do the very thing that Jesus did, which is to allow himself to be loved. We like to say, look, you look around at the world and we're not very good at loving one another. Would it be fair to say? But it's important to know that the reason that we have such a hard time loving one another is because the parts of me that are not good at loving that other person in that moment is the part of me that has not yet been loved himself. And I'm even less good at allowing someone to love me than I am at loving other people. Because of the parts of me that are so afraid that when love gets close to me, it's going to see the parts of me I hate the most and then it's going to leave. And so we're continually allowing Jesus to author and finish my becoming a professional human being. He's not just finishing a thing that is an abstraction that we call faith. He's finishing me. He's finishing us. the most important questions that we're asking in the course of most of our days is not what can I acquire, how, like, you know, what can I get from me? Of course, this is what our world wants us to do, acquisition, acquisition, acquisition. The most important questions are, who am I becoming? And is the person I'm becoming going to be ready for the heaven that's going to get here when it does? And I can't become the person I want to become if I don't have a cloud of witnesses. I can't become the person I want to become if I'm not willing to restrain my addictions in the context of a community. In the context in which, yes, I'm naming all of my symptoms as a way to get to my fear and my shame. And we do so in this way. The author and finisher of faith, for the joy set before him. There's that word again, joy. That we were made for this. We were made to walk in the room. We were made to walk in the room and have everybody turn and say, like, oh my gosh, you're here. I can't believe my good fortune. You're here. Can you imagine? You get to heaven. And there's, you know, 200,000 or 300,000 people just sitting around. And Jesus comes and finds you. And he says, oh my gosh, I need to introduce you to some of my friends. And he starts taking you around. And you're a little embarrassed because you don't know any of these people. What's your name? Susan. He's like, oh my God, have you met Susan? And he spends like 30 minutes introducing you to just a person you've never met before. And all he can talk about is how much he thinks you're wonderful. You're already nervous. I can tell. Right? Right? Because we already, but he's up, and it's good that we have eternity because that's a lot of people that he has to introduce us to. But you see what I mean? The joy set before him of being with us and us being with each other as it was intended on the first page of the Bible. The joy set before him, he endured the cross. We're going to talk about that this afternoon. But what does it mean to suffer? We suffer for a lot of different reasons, but one of the reasons that we suffer is what happens when we decide that we're going to follow the king. There is the suffering that comes because we're going to take off our garments of addiction. That's harder. It's really hard to do. There's a certain suffering that takes place. There's going to be a certain suffering that takes place when you decide that you're going to live a life of love, but you're living in a world of people who have a hard time with us. We'll get to that. Endure the cross, scorning and shame. Now, here's the thing about this. As we said, shame has this tendency of wanting us to be rid of it and not pay attention to it. And what Jesus does is that he walks right up to it, looks it right in the eye, and says, thank you for your service. I don't need you anymore. I have work to do. We see this whole thing being played out in the 21st chapter of John. You know this story. Jesus is cooking breakfast on the beach. The disciples are out fishing. Peter and John see him, and Peter jumps in, swims to shore. He gets there, they all get there, and then Jesus and Peter are going to have this conversation. Right? And he says, do you love me? And you all know the story and the different Greek versions of do you love me and feed my sheep and so forth and so on. But the thing that really strikes me is that you get to the third, and who knows, was it three times? Because he denied it three times. Was it 33 times? I don't know. But we get to the time, and we read, and Peter was grieved in his heart. Jesus asking it a third time. And the writers are just so good at this, right? Because we don't know why he was grieved. We just know that he was grieved when he asked it yet a third time. But I'll tell you what, if I'm Peter, I'll tell you why I'm grieved. I'm grieved because every time he asks me, it's a reminder of what I did. Are you with me? Like, will you just shut up already? You asked me twice. I've answered the question, like, what more do you want from me? Because you do get the sense that Jesus knows that if Peter is going to become the person that Jesus wants him to become, Peter is still going to have unfinished business he has to sort out. There is this sense in which Jesus knows that Peter still houses shame in his neural networks, and he's not going to let that be left alone. Are you with me? He just keeps coming for it. He keeps coming. And he's going to keep coming for this with us. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon what happens with shame. If you've ever done something, you've hurt somebody's feelings, you go to them, you make reparations, they're good, you're good, you feel good about that, and then the next day you're thinking about it and you feel bad again. You ever had that happen? You still feel bad. And people are like, well, I still feel guilty. No, you don't feel guilty, that's shame. This is not guilt talking. This is shame talking, and it has a lot to do with the neurobiology of how shame travels on certain unmyelinated neural networks in your brain, and it lasts a long time. And so it gets wrapped around and entangled in all kinds of things that takes a long time to untangle. And Jesus demonstrates for us, I mean, you've worked with patients, right? You've worked with patients, they have a moment of insight, they come back the next week, and it's as if it never happened. Because the payload of their shame that's wrapped up in their brain and entangled with all these other parts of life, it still has to continue to be told. The story, we're going to tell the story over and over and over again. And of course, I've already told you the story. And so I think that since I told you the story and we had a good moment of insight left, somehow I shouldn't have to do this again. So now I feel ashamed for still feeling this when I come, you see, right? Like, it's great because we'll never be out of job. It'll be awesome. But you see what happens for us. Are we willing to allow Jesus to do with us without condemnation? For curiosity, without condemnation. Are we allowing him and those who are in our cloud of witnesses to do with us what he was doing with Peter? And are we then going to be agents to do the same thing? And we have patients that have had their moment of insight, and you're like, this is great. And then they come back, and then, like, you know, at some point, how many people here have a patient that you've been working with, and you're like, come on already? Yeah, right? You feel like, we've been over this. Right? That 3 o'clock patient that when they, you know, cancel at the last minute, you're like, yes! Because you still get to charge them. You know, it's awesome, right? But this sense that even we as care providers, we weary of evil's work. And it's when I'm wearied of my patient not changing fast enough. When that happens, what that tells me something not about the patient. It tells me something about me. And it tells me that there's something about me that believes I'm not being an effective enough clinician such that if we were to get this done right, this patient would be better. And it's at that moment that evil is not talking to the patient, evil is talking to me. Are you with me? Which is why I, as a clinician, need a cloud of witnesses continually, who are helping me make sure that I'm not listening to the wrong story. I mentioned up here Luke 3:22 to Luke 4. This is about Jesus and his encounter with Satan. This whole notion of what does it mean for him to practice listening to his Father's voice, John 21. This whole notion of 1 Corinthians 12 and 13. Again, we could spend forever and a day about this, but we're going to come to a close here. Notice that when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 12 about the body of Christ. Right. Notice, the body at the time that Paul was writing was completely utilitarian. You know that. We would say, like, we do all kinds of things to demonstrate our value of the body. And the Greeks and Romans did. They had artwork and statues. And so they valued it for its aesthetic appearance, but it was essentially for them utilitarian. It was a tool to be used. If I'm a Roman citizen, and you're not, male or female, I could have sex with you on demand anywhere, anytime I wanted, anyhow. Because your body is a tool. This is completely foreign to us. But it is crucially important that we recognize that when Paul had other words he could have used. He could have said just the church. He could have said the gathering of the believers. He could have said those of you of the way. Right? But he doesn't. Paul, not even the Old Testament talks about it. Paul uses the word the body. And he equates the body with Jesus. And then he equates Jesus' body with us. Are you with me? Paul is addressing his attention at the very thing that was the tool of shame in the culture. Are you with me? And he's taking that very tool and turning it on its head and creating out of it an icon of beauty because he's calling us that body and then he's saying, and we are Jesus in the world. Are you with me? This is so much, the reason this is not as much of a big deal to us is because, like, if you're living in Rome and you're reading this, you're hearing this being read to you, it's blowing your mind. And then he goes on to say, like, well, Yeah, but the eye can't say, because you're not an eye, you don't belong. And he says, if you're a foot, you don't get to say, well, because I'm just a foot, I don't belong. He's addressing shame on both sides of the equation. You see what he's doing here? And he's saying belonging to the body means that in our story, there's no place for shame in an inappropriate way. There's no place for it. This story does not get to be told with shame being in the driver's seat of the conversation. But evil will do everything it can to tempt us to believe that it is. So then I'll just leave the rest of these things. But I want to say this much, that at the end of this conversation, I want to go back to the comment that I made at the very beginning, that the news about shame, on one hand, is far worse than we know. And it's far worse than we know primarily because of what we're not paying attention to, what it's doing that we're not paying attention to. But the news is also far better than we can imagine. And I'll just tell this one story. Our son, who has lived a really beautiful life, our son who's 30. I can tell the story because, again, I've talked about it, and it's giving me permission to tell. When he was in 2020, he was in graduate school. He started graduate school on the West Coast. He grew up in Northern Virginia, but he started graduate school on the West Coast. And this is a guy who lived a radiant life. And lived pretty independently and lived well. And his name's Nathan. And he's a musician, and he's a lot of things. We love hanging out with him. We love being with him. And he's in L.A., and we get a call because we're just checking in. And his mother and I knew immediately that something was wrong. And it was wrong in a way that we couldn't put our finger on, but we didn't recognize the voice that we were hearing other than thought. And it was, and this is a guy who would never ask for help. Like this, he wants to live, he's an adult, I can do this, I can put my hands on by myself kind of guy. So, right. And, we get this call and we decide, without even asking, that we were going to buy two tickets to LA, and we do. And the next day we say, what do you think about us coming? He said, I think it'd be a good idea, which of course was shocking because he never asked us to come for help for anything. And we get to LA, and I didn't recognize him. I mean, he'd been there for less than 4 weeks, and he'd probably lost 10 pounds. And he found himself on the verge of being really in trouble with psychiatric. Never before had we seen anything like this. And it was difficult enough in that you have a psychiatrist and you have a social worker, and we can't do anything to get this kid. Phyllis and I figured we'll go for a couple of days and we'll kind of get things correct and we'll come home. And we stayed for 7 weeks. And on many nights, we went to bed not knowing if he was going to be alive in the morning. I've never been more frightened in my life. I've never felt more powerless as a parent. And the whole notion that something's happening that you can't do anything about, the whole notion of shame was just everywhere. How did we not see this? All the questions. God. He'd been living in our house for 6 months during COVID, up until working out of our house. And there were just many, many, many weeks in which all we did was he'd go to class and he'd come home and we would cook dinner and then we would watch Friday Night Lights and then we'd read scripture and then we'd pray and we'd go to bed. And we just do this. Wash, rinse, repeat. And at times it just felt like nothing was happening. We got connected with a great therapist and with a great psychiatrist, all that. But it just went for weeks, and how long is this going to take? And as I may have said, Phyllis and I have really never been more frightened. And I will tell you that, of course, you might think that we thought that our problem was our son, but our problem was us. Our son had his own problems, but our problem was us. Our problem was our own powerlessness. Our problem was our own shame. Our problem was our own stuff. And the answer to this was that the family of God came out of the woodwork for us, both on the West Coast and even people back on the North Coast. And I say that to say that, you know, there's a phrase that many of us in this room might remember. It was used back in the 80s and 90s. Just say no to drugs. Hear the phrase. And the problem with this, of course, neurologically, is that the part of the brain that hears the words just say no to drugs has got nothing to do with the part of the brain that wants to do the drugs. So it's tricky, right? And no amount of anybody telling anybody facts was necessarily going to change things. Facts were not unimportant, but facts could only be important to the degree that we were not by ourselves with this. And this is what our God has said repeatedly: I'm with you, I'm with you, I'm with you, I'm with you. The challenge for me is that my shame will often have me believing that he's not. And this is why I need a confessional community who can be with me in an embodied fashion that reminds me, not just in the abstract, but in day-to-day, living, breathing, eating, sleeping life, that we are not alone, that our Savior has come to rescue us, not just to take us to heaven, but to create within us outposts of beauty and goodness that we then extend to those around us by delivering the same presence to others. And that, I think, my friends, is really good. With a lot of work, our son made his way over the course of about 18 months back to a place where he is now, and he's in a really good place. But he continues to work on the stuff that he's been working on now for the last 4 years. But it didn't begin 4 years ago, it began a long time ago, as is true for all of us. And so the good news here is that Jesus is not worried about any of this process. He's not worried about it. He is committed to continue to being in the work, being on the beach, cooking us breakfast, asking us if we love him for the purpose of him saying this. This is what he was saying to Peter. Do you love me? He wasn't testing him like he's getting his math exam. He's testing him in order to get Peter's attention away from his shame and onto him, because he keeps saying to Peter, I have work for you to do. I want to know if you love me, because I have work for you to do. I want you to feed my sheep. I need you to be in the game. I'm going to go, and I need you to be in the game. I'm not worried about your shame. What I want is for you to start paying more attention to me than you are paying to it. And when you do that, beauty and goodness is going to happen everywhere you go. And with that, I'm going to pause. You may have things to say.